Today in Studio 360,
Alex in Fatal Attraction.
And you get out!
Patty Hughes in Damages.
Consider this the carrot. Believe me, you don't want the stick.
Cruella De Vil.
I adore puppies.
Is there any actress who plays mean better than Glenn Close?
If you play a strong woman, a lot of people say that you're evil. Put a woman in a position of power and people get very uncomfortable.
I'll talk with her about her career playing strong, complicated women. Right now, Glenn Close is on Broadway in a revival of Edward Albee's A Delicate Balance. And as long as we've been human, we've looked up in the sky and wondered, what the hell is that? And then, 25 years ago, the Hubble telescope came along and let us see it all differently.
We will never succeed in understanding the universe, but we have to try.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead this hour. But first, it's a truth universally acknowledged, even now, that women are often paid less than men for the same jobs, even in liberal Hollywood. But when Sony Pictures' computer system was hacked, suddenly an irrefutable case study of the pay gap was right there, specifically in black and white. For acting in the hit Sony movie American Hustle, Amy Adams and Jennifer Lawrence got significantly smaller profit percentages than their male co-stars did. And now Charlize Theron has used that leaked information as leverage to level the playing field with her co-star, Chris Hemsworth, in the upcoming sequel to The Huntsman. The actress and her agents went back to her studio, not Sony, and demanded that she be paid the same as Hemsworth. As of last week, she's going to be paid more than $10 million. Melissa Silverstein is the founder and editor of Women in Hollywood, and she joins me here today to discuss this. Melissa, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So we generally have been talking about gender inequality in Hollywood for a while. Does this information from the Sony hack change the game, the conversation, significantly?
I'm not sure if it's going to change the game in the long run, but in the short run, anytime we are able to have a conversation, transparent conversation about something like this, which is really hidden, like we don't know how much these people make, it is a great day for gender justice.
Right. And it's unusual in its apples to apples. Same film, same, you know, the male stars are not great, bigger stars. It's a pretty good case study of this problem, yeah?
Well, actually, what it really reveals is how men are able to propel themselves to the top of the Hollywood food chain so quickly. Because Chris Hemsworth was nothing, really, until he got that hammer of Thor in his hand just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And now he's able to make as much money or more than an Academy Award-winning actress.
Kind of crazily, since last week I had to say to my wife, tell me that guy's name again. People probably don't make this argument in Hollywood because if it's this liberal, everybody's equal, we're all on the right side of things place. But is it possible that male stars are simply more bankable than women, or is that just not true?
Well, first comment is I don't necessarily think Hollywood is so liberal
really?
In how it handles gender and race. The people
they
there
talk the
might
talk.
Be, absolutely, but they're not really walking the walk. And so there is a narrative in Hollywood that men are more bankable, and I believe that is a false narrative. But there is a perception that continues in Hollywood that not only is male-centric films positive, but there is actually this perception that women-centric content is a negative. And there is no data to support that. The top movie in 2013 was part two of The Hunger Games. The second top grossing movie in 2014, and it could actually become the number one grossing movie from 2014, is Mockingjay Part 1, starring Jennifer Lawrence, who is now arguably the most bankable actress in Hollywood.
Well, the other thing that we discovered from the hacked Sony information was about the executive team. And it becomes particularly acute and ironic given that the chairperson of Sony Pictures is a woman. Only one of the 17 executives who make more than $1 million a year is a woman, I guess, aside from the chairwoman. And she makes like almost $1 million less than her co-president.
Right.
Again, okay, that's pretty apples to apples.
They have the same title. And she makes almost $1 million less than him. She gets a lower base rate and she has lower bonuses.
And how far does – I mean – okay, it's a first world problem. You make only 2 million, he makes 3 million. You know, does it keep going down at middle levels and lower levels? Does this kind of inequity exist?
Absolutely. One conversation I had on social media end of last year was with a producer who had talked to agents in Hollywood, and basically, point blank, they said, we don't do women directors. So the problem is, if agencies don't invest in directors and in female actresses because they think they have a shorter shelf life, that means that they don't get the opportunities to work at the highest level, and then they don't get those salaries. Mm. So if your agency is not investing in you for the long run, you're not going to be put up for those jobs. And that's why we have this huge gender gap.
And I mean, is your sense, you've been at this, looking at this for a while now, The numbers are pretty irrefutably bad, but is it getting slowly better or not?
Well, the numbers are not moving at all. They're static.
Yeah.
We're having a really robust, terrific conversation. I've been at this 7 years. The conversation has clearly shifted. The data points help make the conversation. But until we see some movement in these numbers, I don't think that we have accomplished what we need to accomplish.
And what's your best bet? If we came back together and talked about this in 3 or 4 years, will we say that was a real moment where the numbers started going in the right direction, people started doing the right thing, or not?
I really hope so. What I think that Hollywood needs is the will. And somebody needs to be brave enough to do the right thing. This is not a problem of talent. The problem is getting the opportunities. Women want to see movies that reflect them. It's just that there is a huge deficit of women on screen, and that's what we need to change.
Melissa Silverstein, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Melissa Silverstein is the editor and founder of Women in Hollywood and the co-founder and artistic director of the Athena Film Festival. Before you'd ever heard of her, Glenn Close was an accomplished stage actress. After her early films, like The World According to Garp and The Big Chill, made her a movie star, she rarely made stage appearances, although when she did, it was a big deal, such as her Tony Award-winning performance as Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard.
The cardboard trees, the painted scenes, the sound here. Yes, a world to rediscover, but I'm not in any hurry.
Now, after more than a decade, she is back on Broadway, starring in Edward Albee's A Delicate Balance. And I am very pleased to welcome her for the first time to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
As an actor, are there particular challenges in doing an Edward Albee play?
Oh, my gosh. It's the hardest dialogue that I've ever tried to learn.
Uh-huh.
Because it was so complex and so unlike the way I talk naturally that—
Or anybody, really.
Anybody. So, yeah. And I've learned that you just have to give your brain time to create the new pathways in order to remember that.
Because sometimes it sounds almost 19th century in its stylization, and then it becomes colloquial and normal and contemporary.
Especially Agnes has a very formal way of talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which certainly gets across her sense of formality that is dissolving and crumbling around her.
Trying to maintain order of some sort, even in her language.
In creating this performance, were you conscious of, I need to show all her sides, I don't want her to seem like this horrible bitch?
Yes, very much so. I did not want her to seem like a horrible bitch. I think on the page she could come off as a horrible bitch. But she's also been a woman who hasn't had any physical love for years. You know, she's not fulfilled in that way at all. She's very needy in that way, but she covers it up and she takes care of the family. But underneath, that's probably the deepest wound for her.
I want to play a clip from the show where Agnes is talking with Tobias, played by John Lithgow.
As the saying has it, the one thing sharper than a serpent's tooth is a sister's ingratitude.
The saying does not have it that way.
Should. Why are you moving?
No, it's getting uncomfortable.
Things get hot, move off, huh? Yes?
I'm not as young as either of us once was.
I'm as young as the day I married you, though I am certain I don't look it. Because you are a very good husband most of the time.
That was Glenn Close and John Lithgow in A Delicate Balance. You two first worked together back in 1982 in the movie adaptation of The World According to Garp. What's it like now as grown-ups being scene partners again?
Well, we've been in this business. We've been acting now for 40 years plus, and we've learned a lot. So we have a lot of craft to fall back on, thank God. So in many ways, it was like kind of skating on smooth ice.
Edward Albee grew up in a rich Westchester, New York family, his adoptive family, and he's often talked about how he felt like he didn't really belong in that world. You were born into such a world, Greenwich, Connecticut, country club, prep school, all that. Did you feel like, hey, this is my tribe, I do belong here?
I don't think I've ever felt that I belong to that world, even though I was born into it, because my parents were really black sheep in that world in kind of a cool way.
Kind of heroic weirdos, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah, they were. They wanted to do things for people and get out of that. They quit the country clubs that their parents had founded. And
Literally founded.
Yes, yeah. And we had this wonderful piece of land, my grandfather's farm that we grew up on, and we could have been in Iowa. I mean, we never went to the country club.
I also hadn't known that you were part of Up With People, which came to my either junior high or high school in Omaha, Nebraska when I was a little kid. And, of course, we thought, it being the period, like, who are these creepy
weirdos.
People?
Creepy people, exactly.
Was that fun, strange?
Well, it's a long story for me.
Yes.
Because Up With People was an offshoot of something called Moral Rearmament.
Which I also didn't know until now.
Yeah, so my parents got kind of seduced by them in the mid-50s. And from 7 to 22, I was in their control.
And in a cult-like way.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But did doing Up With People, was that your gateway drug to show business and acting?
Well, I always wanted to be an actor. It had nothing to do with... I loved the early Disney films. I loved all that. I had this big imagination, probably for reasons which could be analyzed. But I wanted to go to college. I wanted to go to acting school. And I ended up being shunted, if you will, into Up With People. I wrote songs for them. And I was, you know, you're a good little soldier until you realize what you're soldiering for.
And then and you had the good fortune to be in your early 20s in the late 60s and said, enough of this?
Enough of this, exactly. Yeah. So I left with no thank yous or anything and went to the College of William & Mary, where I was a freshman when I was 22 years old.
So you were an old freshman.
I was an old freshman.
you started college late, therefore got out of college late. I guess everything was a little late. You made your first movie at 35.
Yes, well, I came to New York after graduation, and then George Roy Hill saw me in Barnum and put me in The World According to Garp.
What about the doing of it? It seems to me they would be different skills.
Oh, gosh. I remember it so well. I remember going up to George Roy Hill and saying, I hope you will take care of me, because I've heard that a lot of stage actors can't make this transition into film. And he looked down at me and he said, you're right.
Nice.
In my first, I thought that my first movie would be either the back of my head onto somebody else,
yeah,
or hearing my voice and seeing somebody else's face. The hardest adjustment for me was the energy, because on stage you kind of set up this energy force that will project whatever you're doing to the back seats. And my second film was The Big Chill, and I started learning then the power of thought on film, the power of the close-up, and that you can actually see into somebody's soul, actually, when you're doing a film.
I've read that you say you're a terrible auditioner. What does that mean?
Oh,
I can imagine how I would be a terrible auditioner, but what does it really mean in the case of an actual actress?
I just was really not terribly good at it. I didn't
in a technical way, or you like freeze at the
well,
prospect?
Well, if I could keep myself on an emotional edge and kind of keep that together and then walk into the room, I usually hit it out of the ballpark. But if for one reason or another it started kind of dripping away, it was kind of agonizing. I auditioned for Albert Nobbs all those years ago.
Which, something else I didn't know is this movie, wonderful movie you made a few years ago, was a play 30 years ago.
It was a play based on the original story. And I loved it. It was going in for 5 minutes and playing a woman being a man in Victorian Dublin, and I really was bad. And I stopped the audition, and I said, I'm boring myself, so I must be boring you. I'm just going to go home. And then I got a call saying, that was the most interesting thing that happened to us all day. Will you come back? I then called my friend Kevin Kline and said, who is that coach that you go to? Because I'm so tired of you know, not being in control.
So did the coach coach you on how to do auditions?
Yes, he really helped me.
It's interesting how, because you've had so many big, memorable roles at different stages of your career, I think there's a certain generation of people, like my children, who simply think of you as Cruella de Vil. I want to play a clip in which you, she, is talking to a young fashion designer played by Jolie Richardson.
Your work is fresh and clean, unfettered, unpretentious. It sells. And one of these days, my competitors are going to suss out who you are, and they're going to try to steal you away.
Oh, no, if I left, it wouldn't be for another job.
Oh, really? What would it be for?
Well, I don't know, if I met someone, if working here didn't fit in with our plans.
Marriage?
Perhaps.
More good women have been lost to marriage than to war, famine, disease, and disaster. You have talent, darling. Don't squander it.
Well, I don't think that it's something we have to worry about. I don't have any prospects.
Thank God.
That is Glenn Close in 101 Dalmatians. You're like half an octave higher than anything like your real voice, it seems.
My voice is particularly low today because I'm fighting.
Well, maybe that's it. So in that scene, it's interesting to me, when she's not killing puppies, Cruella is a pretty reasonable person.
Yes.
Much of the rest of that role is very cartoonally evil. Is that easier to do than Agnes in A Delicate Balance?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's easier to do, especially if you have wonderful dialogue.
Yeah.
Actually, I think Cruella was a very elegantly written part because she was so witty and kind of evilly witty. The meaner yes. she was, the funnier she, you know, the funnier people thought she was.
And for 5 years recently on TV, on the terrific drama Damages, you played a character named Patty Hughes, who is incredibly cold and calculating and complicated. Does she, for instance, feel very different than Cruella as a character?
Oh, yeah, because Cruella was the devil. So Cruella was just pure evil. Patty, you find at the brilliant writing at the very end, you find why she is the way she is, you know, and she's a damaged person herself from the very beginning. And you,
but all terrible people say that. Oh, he had such a terrible childhood or something.
Well, I think it's kind of true.
Yeah.
But Patty, I mean, it's interesting because there's another phenomenon that I have come across that if you play a strong woman, a lot of people say that you're evil or you're
right.
a bitch. If Patty had been played by a guy, it would have been, I think, quite different.
Yes.
And I remember when I first met the wonderful three writers, their inspiration was David Boies and a book that he had written. And
The famous lawyer.
The famous lawyer. And I said, you realize how different it will make it, you know, when you put a woman in a position of power and people get very uncomfortable.
Glenn Close, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A Delicate Balance, starring Glenn Close and John Lithgow, is on Broadway right now. Coming up, after decades of planning and billions of dollars, we sent the most decked-out telescope ever made into outer space. And then, whoops.
It's as if you went to an optometrist to get some glasses, and the optometrist made the wrong prescription for you.
Just a few final fixes for the Hubble telescope. That's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Unless you're a real astronomy fan, chances are there is only one telescope you can name, the Hubble Space Telescope. Hubble turns 25 this year. The Webb, which is about the same age, is full of sites devoted to nothing but Hubble images. And even now, when new images are released from Hubble, it makes all the science news. This is a chunk of big science infrastructure that we really do sort of love. Studio 360's Krista Ripple explains how these pictures have changed the way we look at outer space.
A few years ago, Elizabeth Kessler made a trip to a telescope. It's a research center just south of San Jose called the Lick Observatory.
And it's amazing because you can go up to the top of this mountain and it's totally dark and you can see actually the Milky Way with your naked eye up there. It's dark enough.
The observatory was open to the public that night, and the telescope was focused on a planetary nebula.
And people asked about, why am I not seeing this in color? I expected to see it in color. And I think that that response is really conditioned by having seen all these images from the Hubble Space Telescope that have sort of taught us to expect to see the cosmos in full color.
Kessler teaches art history at Stanford, and she's also written a book on Hubble's photography. She says that before Hubble,
if you go back through the history of photographing space, color images are relatively rare. So in order to create a color photograph, a photographer would have to take three different photographs of the nebula, one with a filter for red light, one for green, one for blue, and then carefully combine those and align them very precisely so it doesn't look blurry, and then develop them together as a composite.
And those color images generally look unnatural, kind of alien.
Say if we look at photographs from the Voyager missions to Jupiter from the 70s and 80s, the colors there tend to be really psychedelic, purples and pinks, and the red spot on Jupiter is really vividly colored. And there's a different subtlety to the color palette that is in use today.
Not that the Hubble photos are boring at all. They look like someone dumped a sunset into a fog machine. But Kessler says the scientists and technicians who compose these images, from the reams of raw data Hubble sends back to Earth, those scientists are making very specific aesthetic choices.
It tends to be that the background, the sky, is blue, that the pillars of gas and dust in the nebulae are in different tones of reds and orange and yellow. So those look like landscapes. For example, the Eagle Nebula, in its press release, the Pillars of Creation was compared to the buttes of the American Southwest.
That's one of NASA's most famous photos. There are three pillars rising into a soft blue sky. They're gas, but they look like rock. The top of each pillar is haloed in golden light, and pink stars wink through the blue. The pillars themselves have this, like, rusty, earthy color, and it's easy to imagine them rearing out of the ground in Arches National Park.
Or there's examples from press releases of comparisons of the Orion Nebula in the Grand Canyon.
So even though Hubble lets us see 10 billion light years away, the pictures look more familiar than older pictures of space. A lot of the time, that's just a matter of perspective.
So, for example, nebulae with these pillars of gas and dust tend to be pointing upward in Hubble images. And rather than oozing off the page or oozing downward or oozing to the side, there's a kind of attention to light coming from above.
We love these pictures for the same reasons we love a good landscape. And the level of detail just makes them look more real.
It's the same kind of thing that HD television does with that greater detail. There's always a very bright white to very dark black and everything, every tone in between that. And so that does create that sense of three-dimensionality, that sense of mass, that appearance that the nebula or the galaxy is not a flat thing, but in fact rounded and has volume and mass and shape.
Apart from the aesthetics, there's another reason people feel attached to Hubble. It went into space on NASA's first shuttle launch after the Challenger explosion. And then it almost failed.
Since the Challenger disaster, NASA has experienced an 8-year run of blunders, breakdowns, bad planning, and bad luck. NASA hopes a successful Hubble repair will restore some of the reputation the agency forged on the moon.
Something was wrong with Hubble. Zolt Levay is an astrophysicist. I had him tell me about it.
So you launch this telescope above the atmosphere and you expect the images to be tack sharp because you don't have the distortion from the atmosphere. Well, the first images that came back, that was the first indication that oh, we've got a problem, that the images didn't look any better than equivalent images from the telescopes on the ground.
LeVay is one of the people who composes these photos we see from Hubble.
What they didn't know when they launched it was that the main optical element in the telescope, which is a large mirror, which is ground and polished to a very precise surface. Unfortunately, that was polished to the wrong prescription. It's as if you went to an optometrist to get some glasses and the optometrist made the wrong prescription for you.
The technical term for this, if you're interested, is spherical aberration.
11, 10, 9.
Fortunately, from the very beginning, Hubble was designed to be serviced.
3, 2, 1. And we have liftoff. Liftoff of the Space Shuttle Endeavour on an ambitious mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope.
And the repair worked. You can see the video of astronauts fixing the Hubble telescope on YouTube. But fair warning, it's about as exciting as watching someone fix a telescope.
You can do things in zero-G that you would never dream of, right?
Yes, sir.
When the new data started flowing, it was everything NASA had hoped. Hubble helped us figure out the age of the universe. It contributed to the discovery of dark energy, research that won the Nobel Prize. And it made a generation of Americans fall in love with the sublime awesomeness of space. But Hubble has an expiration date. NASA serviced it for the last time in 2009. Eventually, they'll steer it back to Earth and let it drop into the sea. And a few years from now, NASA plans to launch the James Webb Space Telescope. Hubble is about the size of a school bus. Webb will be like a tennis court. Webb should let us see much older things, 600 million years closer to the Big Bang. And NASA's hoping it will blow our minds all over again. For Studio 360, I'm Krista Ripple.
And do we have some beautiful images from the Hubble telescope posted at studio360.org? Why, of course. Michael Benson is a kind of professional Hubble telescope fan. For a decade now, he has been curating its awe-inspiring images of space, as well as curating photos taken by space probes and telescopes on Earth. He's a photographer and a writer, as well as a filmmaker, and he has published these images of space in the kind of big, luscious books that you can lose yourself in for hours. But for his latest one, he's looked backwards, collecting the ways we pictured the universe before we had all this whiz-bang technology, when astronomers and artists had only their eyes, maybe a little telescope, and their imaginations. The book is called Cosmographics, and it covers 4,000 years. Michael Benson, welcome to Studio 360.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me in.
So this book, Cosmographics, is right in one of my sweet spots. I collect old images of the cosmos. I love maps. So really, this is one of my favorite art books ever.
Wow.
Your oldest depiction of the night sky here, I think, is from 2000 BC.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that one?
So the Nebra Sky Disk is exactly the size of an old vinyl record. It's 12 inches wide. It's made out of copper and gold. It has a crescent moon and a full moon made in gold, gold hammered into the copper, and the Pleiades stars. It's the first representation of the universe, graphic representation of the universe known. They believe it's a portable device designed to allow the astrologers, we don't know for sure what they were, to measure the solstices and all of this stuff that the you know, that Stonehenge and other of these astronomical sites did in a large scale, this was a portable way of doing it.
A lot of the images, I mean, Galileo was working just as the telescope was invented. A lot of the images, however, in this book are from before there were telescopes. Apart from this 4,000-year-old gold copper mobile thing, what other kinds of tools did people use to figure out what they were looking at?
There's a misconception that pre-Galileo, pre-Copernicus, depictions of the heavens were kind of spurious or not accurate or what have you. In fact, there was a lot of collection of evidence, work done in mathematics. Ptolemy, you know, the Alexandrian astronomer who wrote the Almagest, based his geocentric cosmology on lots of data. So, it's too easy to just dismiss it as, oh, well, it was wrong because the Earth was at the center.
But that was such a compelling image. It led people to think for the next 1,500 years, yeah, the Earth's at the center of the universe. That was the bad side of powerful images, right?
Yeah. You know, Heisenberg made a fantastic comment. What we see is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. In studying our picture of nature, we mistake our picture of nature for nature itself.
What you've just said, true enough, and Heisenberg said it, but it leads me to my next question, which is the kind of implied relativism about what's real, what's true, by including all these religious images of, you know, biblical creation and so forth, along with scientific images of planets. Are you implying that it just depends on what you're looking for and how you're looking, and your truth is your truth and my truth is my truth?
No, not at all. The whole methodology of science is that we're doomed to fail, or you know, every scientific finding is provisional and can be superseded. And if Ptolemy was wrong, maybe it was necessary to have all of those reiterations of his design graphically so that Copernicus could react against something.
One of the themes of this book is the way that maps and diagrams can themselves produce and propel the search for knowledge rather than just being a nice infographic. How so?
I'm really glad you brought that up. So one of the central things that I learned when I made this book, and one of the central theses of the book, let's say, is that an image can be just as important a source of knowledge and a way of conveying knowledge as words or equations. And not only that, images can be assembled from data sets, and then the image that's assembled allows for the discovery to be made. So Marie Tharp, you know, she started working at the Columbia Oceanographic Institute in the 1950s. And because she was a woman, she wasn't taken very seriously, and she got kind of a desk job while the men got to go out on them. Sonar sounding boats, you know. She started to assemble a map of the sonar sounding data. She discovered that in the middle of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge are a series of interconnected rift valleys, which was a substantial confirmation of tectonic plates. You know, she connected the dots.
She made visual this data that looked like noise or indecipherable.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So that's so interesting because we think science began with visual observation. That was the empiricism. Then now it's all in physics and everywhere else, this reams of abstract data. Sometimes to become a picture again that we can just look at and in some commonsensical way find the truth is still how it works.
Absolutely. That's it.
That's so great. You have Van Gogh's Starry Night here in the book next to this 19th century astronomer's sketch of a galaxy somewhere. They are very similar, which is obviously why you put them together. So how did the evolving scientific depictions of the cosmos influence artists like Van Gogh?
So William Parsons was the Earl of Ross in Ireland, and he had enough money and enough interest, obviously, to build this huge telescope. It was the largest telescope in the world from the mid-19th century until early 20th century. It was 6 tons. They called it the Leviathan of Parsonstown. And by the way, he built it in a location that has about 60 good viewing nights per year because it's Ireland. Anyway, he managed to glimpse during one of those clear nights that what had previously been understood to be a nebula within the Milky Way had this spiral structure, okay? So then he made a detailed drawing of it. So that drawing of what we now know to be the Whirlpool Galaxy caused a sensation in the UK. It made its way into a French book popularizing astronomy by Camille Flammarion, the Carl Sagan of the 19th century. We believe that drawing led directly to Starry Night, the most famous artistic depiction of the night sky. Either it was in the library of the asylum in the south of France, where he went after he cut his ear off, or he saw it in Paris just before.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Lots of the images in this book are just fantastic, stunning artworks. And I understand that one of my favorites is also one of yours from 400 years ago, the one called Et Sic in Infinitum, and so on to infinity. Talk about that, what it looks like and what it is.
Yeah, that's an incredible piece. So that is, I mean, any of the listeners out there who know Kazimir Malevich's Black Square on a White Ground, which was from, I think it was 1916.
Just a black picture.
Pure abstraction, you know. It was a revolutionary piece of modernist art. Turns out that in 1617, Robert Fludd, this English physician and Paracelsian mystic guy, attempted to represent a time before time and space before space. So prior to any let there be light or what we might call a Big Bang, you know. And so his solution was a black square on white ground. That's 1617.
And imagine that this continues in all directions forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Did this book, Cosmographics, come out of how you were already thinking about images of the heavens and existence and the galaxies and everything? And or did it affect the way you think about that stuff?
Well, both, of course. I mean, definitely both. You know, it came from a lot of thinking about the paradox that we will never succeed in understanding the universe, and we certainly won't succeed in presenting something so huge in something that can be held between our hands. But we have to try. It's not just trying and failing. It's trying and succeeding in describing an element that will lead us to the next stage. So in that sense, it's similar to the scientific method.
Michael Benson, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Beside the garden wall, when stars are bright, you are in my arms.
You can see some images from Cosmographics at studio360.org.
My stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
Still ahead this hour, one of our listeners makes a decision that'll change her whole life because of the song.
I hope you dance.
And I hope you'll stay with us. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Move Let the man go through.
You probably know Mike Doty as the lead singer of the band Soul Coughing, but he decided that in 2014 he wanted to compose a rock opera based on the Book of Revelation.
It is an absolutely terrifying monster movie, psychedelic tale of destruction, and I just thought, with the right kind of music and, you know, great actors sort of declaiming the text and the right visuals, it would just be a great show.
We followed him all year long as he tried to make good on his New Year's resolution, from early work in progress.
Right things you have seen and would is and will be. Right things you have
to more recent and more polished versions.
Right the things you have seen and would is and what will be.
To where we are now in 2015, and he's done it. And later this month, on January 27th and 28th, you can see and hear the world premiere of Mike Doty's Revelation with a full ensemble at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. You can get tickets right now at studio360.org.
Write the things that you see and then send it to the seven churches. In his right hand were seven stars, and from his mouth came a sword. His face was as the sun shines at noon.
And since it's a new year, it means it's time for new resolutions. For the third year in a row, we've asked you to declare your New Year's resolutions. Not about exercising more or getting into juice cleanses, although far be it from me to talk you out of juicing or cleansing. But we've asked you to get ambitious in a different way. What is the creative project that you've been wanting to take on and just needed an extra push? This year, we heard from more than 100 of you willing to step up to the plate. One of them was Garmin Herigstad, and he is with me now on the line. Hi, Garmin.
Hello, Kurt.
So where am I reaching you?
Bellingham, Washington.
Which is basically southwestern Canada, right?
Yeah, we're the Tijuana of British Columbia.
Yeah. And what do you do for a living?
Well, for 27-plus years, I worked in movie effects and television effects. But I'm kind of trying to transition over to be more of an artist.
You've had a pretty successful-looking career in visual effects. You've worked on Harry Potter and X-Men and lots of other big movies.
Yeah, and it was a pretty exciting experience. And my job, in a sense, working on the movies, as movies got bigger and bigger and bigger, for me, they felt like they were getting to be less and less creative and more about just knocking out, you know, burning buildings and smashing cars and things like that.
Right.
And whenever I see some really beautiful calligraphy or hand-drawn lettering, my heart just kind of melts.
So, Garmin, exactly what is your New Year's resolution for 2015?
I plan to make a hand lettering or calligraphy using either, like, hand-drawn pencil-drawn letters or using traditional calligraphy pens and brushes to letter the entire book of Proverbs.
Why Proverbs?
It's about 700 little snippets of wisdom of varying lengths from, you know, one sentence to like a couple of paragraphs. And then I thought, well, it would force me to do a huge body of work, which would help me build up my skills.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, there's a lot of variety in each one. And so it could lend itself to very formal, old-style Gothic calligraphy, and then some of them I could even do it like with a piece of chalk, like it's written on a blackboard.
Do you have favorites?
Well, I have a couple of favorites. Some that have stuck with me for a long time. Proverbs 27:1-2. It says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth." Kind of fits this situation. What I'm doing right
yes,
now is that
yes.
I'm setting a goal, but I guess I want to keep my expectations out there.
And assuming you get through it and you're done, what do you plan to do with the finished artifact?
Well, I kind of posted it on Facebook that I had this idea, and then one of my friends said, well, I'll buy one. or maybe somebody will hire me to make a menu based on something I did.
No, thank God you're doing the Bible. You don't want to just then go to a menu after that, you know?
Well, if I got to pay the rent.
Well, I really hope it works out, and we will be checking back in with you as the year goes on.
Great.
Thanks. Garmin Herigstad listens to the show on KUOW in Seattle. And over the next few weeks, we'll hear from the other listeners who are submitting themselves to our constant monitoring throughout 2015. In the meantime, a giant thank you to everybody who shared their creative resolutions with us. You are incredibly ambitious. And by the way, if you're keeping your resolution without us nudging you all year long, let us know. If you're a regular listener, you know we ask you to share stories about works of art or entertainment that have changed your life.
My name is Mary Miller. I'm from St. Pete, Florida.
Mary Miller listens to the show on WUSF out of Tampa. Some years ago, she found herself in love. She had fallen hard for a guy who flipped houses for a living.
When I met this gentleman, he represented all romance. He had traveled down here on the intercoastal waterway on a boat, and he was going to travel the world. And he made his money in order to do this by taking houses and turning them around and selling them for five times what he paid for. And I fell in love with the romance. I fell in love with the idea that I could live my dreams of traveling the world, live on a boat, and then we broke up. I gave my heart to this guy. He trampled it, and I was gonna teach him a lesson that I could go out there in his world and make the kind of money he'd made and make a name for myself. And I didn't even own a drill to flip a house. I had something to prove, though. I had something to prove. I was in my car on the way to the bank to sign a loan for $400,000, and this song came on the radio. And I heard Leanne Womack sing.
And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. I hope you dance. I hope you never.
And I was sitting in the comfy bank chair. I had the pen in my hand, and I'm ready to sign the dotted line for $400,000 in home equity line of credit, which seems ridiculous because at the time my income was less than $20,000. And I heard the lyrics in my head. Don't let some hell-bent heart leave you bitter. When you come close to selling out, reconsider. And I just sat there with the pen in my hand. I just finally put it down and said, I can't do this. As it happened, within a year, the whole housing market totally crashed. And I would have lost everything. I would have lost every dime had I signed that dotted line. It was over. It had been over between me and this fellow, and I had to let it go. And it was the best thing I ever did. Oh, thank you so much. I put my money into music equipment, and my singing had just taken off.
Welcome, everyone, to our show. I'm so happy to be here tonight.
Ooh, Dean. Oh, Dean just puts me in the mood. Now I get to sing in retirement communities, and I have so much fun. I love it.
Oh, it's just going to be so much fun tonight because these are the best of the business.
We'll be singing together Harry Belafonte, Matilda, and the Banana Boat song. Goofy stuff, that's amore. Their faces light up, all the cares drop away from them, and it takes them out of the pain and suffering, the loneliness that can come to all of us. That's what music does. And for me to be able to enjoy that with them, it's the greatest gift. What I learned from these folks who have lived into their 80s and 90s is pretty similar to what Leanne Womack sings about in her song, I Hope You Dance. Living might mean taking chances, but they're worth taking. And loving might be a mistake, but it's worth making. They teach me how to live, how to take risks, how to be true to myself, because life is short. One day you'll find that the time has passed, and when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, that's it.
That's Mary Miller. She listens to the show on WUSF in Tampa. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with help from Eve Asher. And once again, if some piece of music or a book or movie or any other work of art has ever changed your life, tell us about it, and we might put your story on the air. Go to studio360.org and leave us a comment. In any case, thanks for listening. And remember, if you're in or around New York City on January 27th or 28th, you are invited to join us at the world premiere performances of Mike Doty's rock musical Revelation at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space. I will be at the one on January 27th talking to Mike. Information and tickets are at studio360.org. I'm excited to see the show, and I hope to see you there, too. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoek.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360... In the musical Rent, the villain is a greedy landlord. So it's kind of fitting that Rent is the first Broadway show to play in Cuba since the revolution. Rent goes to Havana next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.